Welcome to Wild West Podcast, where fact and legend emerge. These are stories of individuals who made the history of the Old West come alive, bringing with them the birth of legends, brought to order by a six-gun, and laid to rest with their boots on. Join us now as we take you back in history to the legends of the Wild West. Hello, everyone. My name is Brad Smalley. I'm the narrator for Wild West Podcast. Mike King and I would like to take this time to thank all of our listeners who have supported our stories of the Wild West. Because of you, our listeners, we have generated nearly 750,000 plays in 12,927 cities over 152 countries. And to show our appreciation, we have produced a special show for you about Bat Masterson's return to Dodge City, Kansas in 1875. What you are about to hear is an individual historical reflective account of Bat Masterson's return to Dodge City, Kansas. The motive for Masterson's return is being prompted by both his concerns for his older brother and an economic opportunity being made possible through various insiders who want to promote the cattle trade of 1877. The story is built around the foundational meanings of courage on the frontier, for civilization comes with a cost. It's the harshest cost of all, revealing every flaw to what man knows about courage in plain sight. I returned to Dodge City in the spring of 1877. I left with the news of gold strikes in the Black Hills of South Dakota in July of 1875. I always looked for the next great adventure. The gold strikes gave me the idea of excitement, but soon bogged me down. I needed to seek a new challenge, as my last experience had gotten old and cold. I needed the buzz of a new thrill, the thrill of the unknown, the seeking of new responses that would push my limits. And this time, it was to be a doozy. I tingled just from the thought of it. I had to go for a long ride on the train to tame my excitement. I'd received word from Dodge City that I had become a favorite in the upcoming Ford County Sheriff's election. Before I left Cheyenne, I stopped in at the local tailor shop to purchase some traveling clothes. After all, I wanted to make a significant presence when I arrived back in Dodge City. I'd earned enough money to buy a good fit of clothes and set up a gambling business in Dodge City. I then boarded the next train bound for Dodge. The train was at full speed, rocking and clanking to the wheels, hitting each iron rail with an imperfect rhythm. I looked out from the window. It was like a mirror flickering away at the flat landscape, which told the story of unsettled land. The mid-morning sun was radiant to the all-watching eye, its light creeping into every corner, bathing the passenger car in a warm glow, a world with shades of truth. The frontier made no mistakes in the ability to conquer, for civilization came with a cost. It's the harshest cost of all, revealing every flaw to what a man knows about courage in plain sight. Over time in this ruthless land, I'd come to realize that courage is nothing less than indifference to hardship and pain. A man's courage in the frontier is his way of maintaining virtue, a virtue that's always respected, even when associated with vice. I thought back over the past year as I sat alone and watched the countryside reveal its unresolved stretch into a vast landscape with a seamless horizon. I could not shake the thoughts of the tragic death of Molly Brennan and how she sacrificed herself for me. I'd become a fortunate man that night for both the bravery of Molly and my good friend Ben. Ben not only saved me from the vigilance of Corporal King's comrades, but also nursed me back to health from my shattered pelvis. After the shooting incident with Corporal King, I returned home. There, I had time to think about my new and unsought status as a man-killer, a noted gunslinger. A tag like this would follow me everywhere I went. The train rattled eastward from Cheyenne, Wyoming territory, where I spent the last 2 months amongst a flood of gold seekers who had been arriving since early winter. Cheyenne was the jumping-off place for the rush to Black Hills goldfields. The news of a gold rush doubled the population by winter. The town was seething with excitement. The excitement of gambling halls, saloons, dance halls, variety theaters, and whorehouses were all packed and turning away business. While in Cheyenne, I received a letter from my brother Ed, dated March 1877. The letter urged me to return to Dodge City. Ed described how new opportunities might make place with the upcoming April elections, that James Dog Kelly might have a good chance of becoming the newly elected mayor. The news of Kelly's appointment would allow me to invest my money in Dodge City Gambling House, something I'd always wanted to do. James Kelly told Ed that if he were elected mayor, he would need good men to keep law and order, that I was on the top of his list to become the county sheriff. Ed wrote how he wanted to be a police officer. He said he'd been encouraged by Larry Dagger to be his deputy. I remembered back when Dagger was first appointed Marshal of Dodge, and how some of the businessmen in Dodge felt Dagger was not suitable for the position. Marshal Dagger was not renowned as a fighting man. I was concerned about my older brother Ed taking on the responsibility as an officer of the peace, especially in a cattle town. I remembered Molly and Ben's stories of the conflicts erupting between merchants and cowboys. Ed was not the type to encounter the cruel acts of the Texas cowboys, especially under the influence of whiskey. Ed and I hunted buffalo together in the early 70s when Dodge City was just a settlement. We made frequent visits to Dodge City to sell our buffalo hides. Dodge City, even in the first years, was a hard-case settlement in a hard-case country. Even before the extension of the Santa Fe Railroad and the news of the Texas herds, Dodge was a center of homicide and violence. The reputation had exceeded through corrupt members of the Vigilantes Committee and the acquired reputation of being the wickedest city on the plains. Now I was returning, but this time to make sure my brother was safe under my protection. The sound of the steam whistle blared to notify the passengers of the train's arrival. I reflected my past within a few seconds of the coachman's voice, which echoed under the blast of steam. Next stop, Dodge City. The train began its approach to a new destination in my life. I could feel the brakeman ease the locomotive's steam engine to a stop. I looked out the window across the loading dock. The number of framed buildings now occupying Front Street astonished me. It was this Dodge City had grown overnight. I stood up using a cane to brace my stand, reached up to the overhead luggage rack, and limped out the depot loading dock. I pulled from my vest pocket a watch and checked the time at noon. The sun bore down upon my black derby hat and casted a slight shadow as I took a glance over the plaza. I saw my brother Ed approaching the depot. Ed wore a big smile. He had a kind of soul, type of person who would try to resolve conflict through peaceful means. Ed wasn't as colorful, direct, or decisive as me. I felt like I had to look after Ed, primarily after he had written to me about taking a deputy's position under Dagger. "Hey, Bat!" yelled Ed over the roar of the locomotive, giving off pressure from the giant steam engine. I stood on the loading platform holding my bag as I watched Ed approach with a big smile. It only took one bounce to the platform for Ed to reach me to deliver a big hug. "Oh, hey, you're back," exclaimed Ed. "So happy to see you, little brother. You know, I have a lot to tell you, especially about the political affairs here in Dodge City." Ed reached down and picked up my one carry-on bag. "Let me take your bag and we'll load them up on the buckboard. I'll show you around while we take a short trip over to the Cox Hotel." As Ed and I mounted the buckboard, I looked around Front Street with amazement. The town had grown into a small metropolitan community. Front Street, a wide road running east and west just north of the Santa Fe tracks, with their principal cross street, Bridge Street, or Second Avenue, led to the toll bridge over the Arkansas River. For two blocks each way from 2nd Avenue, Front Street widened into the plaza with business establishments strung along the north side of the square. The depot, water tank, and freight house were at the east end of the plaza. The Calaboose, a one-room square building, was immediately south of the tracks and served as a jail. It was made of solid 2x6 timbers, spiked flat sides, had floors, walls, and a ceiling. On the second floor perched a light board shack which served as an office for the city judge and clerk. The Dodge House, Deacon Cox's famous hotel, was located two blocks east of 2nd Avenue, at Railroad Avenue and Front Street, outlined the northern corner of the plaza. BB's Iowa Hotel was at 3rd Avenue and Front Street. "You know, Dodge City elections are to be held on April 3rd, said Ed. "The elections would be an excellent opportunity for you to cash in on the political front. Ed paused. Especially if James Kelly gets elected mayor. I would have to think that Bob Wright and our friend Michael Sutton is behind this election, I replied. Why do you say that? Asked Ed. You know well as I do, Bob Wright's a wealthy merchant, I stated. Bob Wright owns the town's biggest wholesale liquor concern. He and his friends, like James Kelly and others who handle large transactions, have become personal friends with cattle barons and trail bosses. You're right, Ed agreed. Bob Wright and Kelly feel the men who bring prosperity to Dodge are to receive a hospitable treatment. What are a few smashed windows and shattered back bar mirrors compared to hundreds of thousands of dollars in their pockets? They need to make sure these free-willing spenders are made to feel welcome, concluded Ed with a laugh. Ed pulled up to Hambell's livery. I'll let you off here, said Ed. At the livery stable, I ran into the owner, Hambell. Ham had blue eyes and brown hair, was of spare build but broad-shouldered. He had a decided Roman nose and a very determined chin. His first business in Dodge City was to build an 85 by 125-foot sod livery stable. The livery was known far and wide as the Elephant Livery Stable with an elephant painted on the side. The livery stable served as a rendezvous and bedding down place for horses and mules, as well as people from throughout the region. Ham informed me that the saloon keepers at Dodge wanted a hard case marshal to crack down on lawlessness during the upcoming summer cattle drives. The cattle drives would be the time when 200,000 head of cattle would be coming up the trail from Texas, and with them, more than 2,000 rambunctious cowhands. Ham suggested that I run for the upcoming Ford County Sheriff's election. He said that Bassett was no longer eligible to run in the next election because he had served out his terms. I just shook my head at the idea. No, I don't think so, Ham, I said. The politics in Dodge City are well divided into two schools of thought on how severely the laws are to be enforced. The saloon keepers and the smaller merchants want their property protected. The faction of townspeople naturally favors the stern treatment of Texans who feel the urge to clean out the town. That's why Mayor Hoover segregated the wilder visitors below the deadline, Ham continued. There's no change in that deadline which exists south of the Santa Fe tracks, I said. These places on the south side of the tracks have become the boardwalks from hell. Besides, I would not want to enforce any new laws that might bring harm or offend the growing number of wives and children who seek refuge on the north side of the tracks. I smiled and tipped my hat. The prospect of taking the Texans over the gambling tables is much more pleasing to me than protecting the Dodge City saloons and citizens on a sheriff's pay. Now, how about that horse? Sure, Bat, replied Ham. I'll go pick you out a fine one. Ham left the entrance of the livery and entered the stables at the back. It did not take long for Ham to pick out an excellent horse, saddle, and rig for me. I paid Ham for the horse and saddle and walked over to the Cox Hotel, where my brother Ed had made arrangements for room and board. I checked into the hotel, had a meal, and waited for sunset. Sunset's when the gaslit lanterns dimly shined in the streets of Dodge City, and when the boardwalks from hell would come to life. It was on June 6, 1877, when Robert Gilmore entered the Lady Gay Saloon. He was a small, inoffensive fellow known about town as Bobby Gill. His only vice is an overwhelming desire to rid the city of its liquor supply by consuming it. Sometimes his imagination was painful and tiresome. Once he became drunk, he would create his world or situations which never happened. He became known as the town's orator, and would stand in the middle of the street making vocal reprises of specific political figures. On this particular day, he tanked up in the Lady Gay, where I attended the faro table. I watched Bobby purchase a full bottle of whiskey, exit to the street, and begin his alcoholic oration on the sidewalk. Bobby started his chanting oration to an onlooking crowd by saying, "Say here, everyone. I am Bobby Gill. I have a story for you. It's about a sty, a fat one indeed. This sty was raised in a swamp and fed in a hog trough. The dagger sow that bore him named him Larry. He being this dagger fowl was suckled in fear, for he runs from the click of every six gun." In that instance, after hearing Gilmore's first series of statements, I saw Bobby was headed for trouble. I turned to the gentleman at the table and politely said, "Excuse me, gentlemen. I need to support a drunkard in need, for I am fearful the orator will soon be calling his undertaker. Bobby began his second statement of displeasures before I could reach him by saying, "O Lord, we pray thee, protect us with thy mighty hand, for the coward Larry Dagger knows not how to make a stand. The further up your creek you go, the worse he gets, and Marshal Dagger is at the head of it." In a panic, I quickly exited the Lady Gay Saloon, but it was too late. Suddenly, the 300-pound Marshal Dagger jumped from the crowd of onlookers. "I make exception to these remarks," yelled Dagger, grabbing Bobby Gill by his collar. I watched Bobby saunter, so much so that Marshal Dagger felt it necessary to administer a few paternal kicks in the rear. That was the breaking point of my patience. At that moment, I saw Dagger kick Bobby ruefully. I was blinded by a 5-course serving of rage that tasted bitter. I ran in the direction of Dagger, reached out, and found my arms around the marshal's neck with such force that it resulted in Bobby Gill's escape. I tackled Dagger and held him so tight that he couldn't fight back. I felt guilty, but I couldn't stop. So many years of subtle bullying sank deep into my mind and added a divine spice that competed the vexed dish that I was serving. I knew I should have put an end to it, apologized before I made it worse, but I didn't have it in me to stop. Dagger then grappled with me and at the same time called upon the bystanders to take my gun and an assist in the arrest. "Help me deal with this lawless man," yelled Dagger. At this critical moment, Joe Mason appeared upon the scene and grabbed my pistol. But I was determined not to surrender. Half a dozen Texas men went to the marshal's aid. I came near getting a hold of a gun from among several who were strewn around the sidewalk that had joined in on the ruckus. I saw Dagger pull his gun from his holster, and he started to beat me over the head. The first blow from Dagger's pistol handle struck me on the top of my head. The blood flew upon Joe Mason. A sudden gush of pain jolted throughout my body. My stomach ached. My arms lost tension, and my legs had begun to weaken. "They will not get the better of me," I thought as I dropped to the ground. My tongue was soaked in the taste of blood. Bruised and winded, with my head in agony, I grabbed Dagger's foot and pulled him to the ground. My head was pounding. I kicked at my attackers and warded off several blows with my arm.
My next memory of my beating and humiliation was behind bars in the local jail. Surrounded by four walls, there was nothing else to do but stare at them. To look at the carvings gouged by other prisoners, anything to pass the time. Slowly, I conjectured absurd meanings from the wall's markings. I began to reflect on my future inside the jail, recovering from my wounds. Maybe it was time for me to get some revenge. Perhaps it was time to put on a badge. Putting on a sheriff's badge would take courage. After about 2 hours in the pokey, I heard raised voices through the closed door of my jail cell. The ensuing argument broke my thoughts about revenge. The sounds were recognizable. The first was Bobby Gill, and the second voice was my brother Ed. Ed had been appointed assistant marshal the day before. He had made his first arrest of the season. He hunted Bobby Gill down that afternoon and added insult to injury when he lodged Gill in the pokey beside me. I thought about Ed's appointment as deputy marshal. I would have been entirely happy if Ed would not have signed on as deputy marshal. I liked having Ed around. I loved my eldest brother more than anyone else in the world, but not as a peace officer. Ed just wasn't cut out for the job. He was gentle, easygoing, liked everyone, and was liked by everyone who knew him for longer than a minute. There was no heat in his voice. He was very different from me. He took time to absorb things and then responded more than reacted. He would try and dampen situations rather than add to the flames. But that wouldn't preserve him from being gunned down by some hot-headed Texan who wouldn't give himself a chance to know Ed for as long as a minute, and would only look at that hated badge on his wishbone anyway. There was no question then or later of Ed's courage. In a showdown, much as he hated violence, Ed had as much guts as anyone, and more than most. Ed was simply a born lover of humanity who insisted on giving everyone the benefit of the doubt. That tendency to wait until a man proved he was a louse could be fatal. After a night in the cooler with Gill, it was my turn to confront Judge Dan Frost. The following day, I was hauled into police court before my old friend, Judge Frost. Frost fined me $25 for a fracture in the peace in a disorderly saloon in Red Light District. At the hearing, Gil also pleaded guilty, but to my surprise, Bobby asked the court for special consideration. Jesus Christ died on the cross for just such sinners like me, pleaded Bobby. Judge Frost considered the point well taken and let Gil off with a $5 fine. I left Judge Frost upset and rejected over the Gil incident. It only took Gil a few minutes before he was back on Front Street with a bottle, narrating to the citizens of Dodge City. I was amazed by Gil's oration skills as I stood in the corner, listening to his phrases. When the darkness overpowers you, hold on to the last of the light, and know that when it is gone, you held on. You can survive in the dark. When you burn, rise from the ashes. You have done what no one else will. And through the pain, you can stand up when others stay down. A few days later, the Dodge City Council sympathized with me by ordering the fine be remitted. Somehow, the incident between Dagger and I convinced the Republicans of Ford County that I was the man for the sheriff's office to replace Bassett. I did not reject the idea, particularly since Larry Dagger was being detached from his Marshall star. I wanted to get even, and agreed to run for sheriff as the nominee of the Republicans. All I wanted was revenge on Dagger. The need for revenge was like a relentless and unceasing rat gnawing in my soul. Only the cold steel of a rat trap could stop it, a trap I would devise for Larry Dagger. Taking the election from Larry Dagger would be the first start in my lasting revenge. Furthermore, I was attracted by the prestige of being sheriff of Ford County. At the same time, I decided to purchase an interest in a piece of the Lone Star Dance Hall. I did so with my Cheyenne winnings, so I may be fine financially when I assumed public office. The Lone Star Saloon had the reputation as a deadfall, jammed full of free and easy girls, long-haired buffalo hunters, and wild and woolly cowboys. The place was much infested with vestiges of a rough culture. Entering the site left an opportunity for the darkest of minds to flourish, providing what people cannot admit in the open, what they desire. On the night of September 25th, 1877, Ed and I were lounging around Beatty and Kelly's restaurant. Then, out of nowhere, the sound of a gunshot sharpened my senses with a rush of adrenaline. I looked over at Ed, and he held his breath. I saw him strain to hear with every ounce of his concentration where the shots were coming from. Ed's prickled ears relaxed. "No threat here," said Ed. My ears strained for more sounds, more clues as to where the gunshot had originated. I ran to the doorway and looked out into the street. An over-exhilarated visitor by the name of A.C. Jackson fired off three more shots. He was on his horse in front of the restaurant. Jackson held the smoking revolver in his hand. It was as if the disease of whiskey in his mind had manifested the pistol in his hand. It was that reckless impulse that alarmed me, the impulse that soberness cures and indifference magnifies. So I saw the gun as a poison to both him and the ramblers on the other end. I ran low out into the street and ordered the festive cowboy to halt. "Not me, not tonight, Marshal," yelled Jackson. "I'm going to skip out for camp." The cowboy turned his horse to ride out of town. I pulled my revolver and fired when the order was disobeyed. "Halt," I said. "Halt." Ed joined me by approaching the rider from the boardwalk. Ed fired at the fugitive. One of Ed's shots must have hit the horse, as it seemed to cringe. The rider spurred the horse once more and dashed out of town, off in the direction of his camp. I fired two more shots at him, but without effect. I mounted my horse to give chase when I heard Ed say, "What the hell, Bat? What are you doing? Just let it go. Nobody's hurt. After all, the cowboy's on his way out of town." "You do not understand, Ed," I replied. "The man's broken the law and he should be arrested." I gave my horse a good kick and imparted the chase on the escaping cowboy. It did not take long for me to get the sight of the shooter, but when I was about to fire on the shootist, I found that my revolver had not a load in its chambers, so I had no other choice but to return.
The next morning at breakfast, I began reading an excerpt from the Ford County Globe. The relatively harmless gunfire in the streets of Dodge City caused both the Ford County Globe and the Dodge City Times to lecture against leniency with gun players. The Globe quoted Mayor A.B. Webster as saying, "Some of the boys, in direct violation of the city ordinance, carry firearms on our streets without being called to account for it. They do so in such an open manner that it does not seem possible that our city officers are in ignorance of the fact." The Times editorial was somewhat more biting in dealing with the Texas weakness for discharging firearms. "Mr. A.C. Jackson is a gay and festive Texas boy, and like all true sons of the Lone Star State, he loves to fondle and practice with his revolver in the open air. It pleases his ear to hear the sound of this deadly weapon. Aside from the general pleasure derived from the shooting, the Texas boy makes shooting inside the corporate limits of any town or city a speciality. He loves to see the inhabitants rushing wildly around to see what all this shooting is about, and it tickles his heart to the very core to see the city marshal coming towards him at a distance, while he is safe and securely mounted on his pony, and ready to skip out of town and away from the officer. The program of the Texas boy, then, is to come to town and hum around until he gets disgusted with himself, then to mount his pony and ride out through the main street, shooting his revolver at every jump. Not shooting to hurt anyone, but shooting in the air, just to raise a little excitement and let people know he's in town. In order to put a stop to this, the carrying of concealed weapons within the city limits has been prohibited. But this has only partially stopped the practice. Several times this summer, the town has been thrown into excitement by the firing of revolvers in the middle of the streets, and the marshals have become very much aggravated over the matter and determined to put a stop to it if possible. Last Tuesday, September 25th, the sound of the revolver was heard several times in quick succession. The police were on the alert in a moment, and everybody rushed towards where the sound had come from. Men hatless and women with their back hair down hastened to see whether their absent friends were safe. But all this excitement was caused by Jackson indulging in his favorite amusement of shooting. However, he came out the loser, and that is some consolation. He was riding down Front Street, and about opposite Beatty and Kelly's he commenced to shoot. He had shot two or three times when the police got their eyes on him. Bat Masterson ordered him to halt, but nary a halt would he. He says, "I'm going to skip out for camp," and bang, bang went his gun. Bat had a gun too, and he immediately brought it to heel on the festive cowboy's horse. Instantly after Bat shot, Ed got in a shot. The horse seemed to cringe, but being spurred on, dashed out of town and off toward camp. Two more shots were fired after him, but without effect. Bat then mounted a horse and gave chase, but when he was about to hail the shootist again, he found that his own revolver had not a load in his chambers. So what else could he do but return? Jackson's horse proved to be mortally wounded, but the noble animal carried its ride a mile or two from the city at a rapid gait, and then fell to the ground and rose no more. Jackson hoofed it the balance of the way to camp. This will probably serve as a slight check to the practice of shooting just for fun inside the city limits. Ed entered the restaurant from the sun-baked dryness of Front Street. The cool, late September wind followed him to my table. Ed removed his hat and caught a glimpse of my stern face. The squint in my eyes must have reflected my discontent for the morning air. "How's breakfast?" asked Ed as he pulled up a chair. "Why the doom and gloom? And what's up with the stern look?" he asked. I quickly cast my eyes down to the newspaper sitting on the table. "This is what's wrong," I said, pointed to the front page article of the Globe. "You can't be soft-shelled with these men," I said. "The papers are all over us the way we handled the Jackson incident." I pushed the paper in Ed's direction. "Here, read it for yourself," I said with a forceful voice. "You can't let him get the bulge on you. If you're a tenth of a second late in judging a man's intentions, you're on your way to Boot Hill. Some of these Texans aren't bad fellows, but when they have a skin full of booze, they'll shoot anything that moves. That's the way they live. They might be sorry as hell the next morning when they wake up in jail wondering what they did to land there, but it won't do you much good." "Stop fussing, Bat," Ed said mildly. "They don't scare me with all that whooping and hollering. They're just kids, most of them, out on a spree." "Damn it, I want you to be scared. Scared enough to watch out for your own skin." There were times I felt like the world was slowly disappearing in front of me. This was one of them. Or maybe it was just me who was unable to reach Ed. His attitude in knowing danger and recognizing a threat was fading away. He was just too easygoing, and I had to let it go. I had to make a decision on staying close to him for protection, or make my move on being elected for the sheriff of Ford County. On September 27, 1877, I resigned my appointment as city officer. The October election for a county sheriff was fast approaching. I knew if I had any hopes of winning over Dagher, I had to approach two key figures in the community, one being Charlie Bassett and the other Bob Wright. I knew I had to put the political machine in motion for me to win the election. I had to make enough men of both factions believe I was the man to wear the sheriff's badge. I had to convince them that I could be tough but preferred not to be. Bob Wright looked favorably upon my candidacy. He campaigned for me by describing me as a gentleman by instinct, pleasant manners, good address, and mild disposition. That is, until he is aroused, said Wright. Then, for God's sakes, look out. He told the citizens of Dodge City that I had much natural ability and good, hard common sense. High-toned and broad-minded, cool and brave, a most loyal man to his friends. Wright confessed to my abilities by saying, if anyone did him a favor, he never forgot it. My announcement for candidacy was founded on earnest. I wanted the citizens to know I was seeking the suffrages of the people. I had no pledge to make, as pledges are usually considered before election to be mere claptrap. The Shin brothers, W.C. and Lloyd, who owned and edited the Dodge City Times, threw me a plug on October 13, 1877. Mr. W.B. Masterson is on track for sheriff, and so announces himself in this paper. Bat is well known as a young man of nerve and coolness in cases of danger. He has served on the police force of this city and also as undersheriff, and knows just how to gather in the sinners. He is qualified to fill the office, and if elected, will never shirk from danger. I was encouraged by the support I received from the Dodge City Times, so I decided to make an official announcement. I wrote the Times, and they printed my request on October 18, 1877. At the earnest request of many citizens of Ford County, I have consented to run for the office of sheriff at the coming election in this county. While earnestly soliciting the suffrages of the people, I have no pledges to make, as pledges are usually considered before election to be mere claptrap. I desire to say to the voting public that I am no politician and shall make no combinations that would be likely to in any wise hamper me in the discharge of the duties of the office, and should I be elected, will put forth my best efforts to so discharge the duties of the office that those voting for me shall have no occasion to regret having done so. Respectfully, W.B. Masterson. As it turned out, the town was pretty well divided on the subject of Masterson versus Dagher. Dagher had more political influence, Masterson more general popularity. Bat was elected by a margin of 3 votes in November of 1877 for a 2-year term. On November 10th, only a few days after I took office as the new sheriff of Ford County, my brother Ed's humane approach to the problems of law enforcement almost came to a tragic conclusion. It started with a typical row in the Lone Star involving two sojourning Texans. Bob Shaw accused Texas Dick Moore of having robbed him of $40, while both gentlemen were under the weather the night before. Since both of the hungover disputants were armed, hungry, and jumpy bystanders at the Lone Star sent a hurry call to the marshal's office. My brother Ed answered the summons. When Ed opened the door, he witnessed Shaw near the bar with a huge pistol in his hand and a hogshead of blood in his eye, ready to relieve Texas Dick of his existence in the world. I would have ordered Shaw to drop his gun and would have fired a split second later if he had refused my order. But Ed, being a kind-hearted soul, advanced slowly toward Shaw and quietly ordered him to hand over his gun. Ed's action, of course, took a lot more courage than gunning the man down forthwith. When Ed approached Shaw with his order to turn over his gun, Shaw simply replied, "Keep out of this, or you'll get yours along with this thieving skunk." "I take no pleasure in taking you down," Ed replied. "None." Ed approached Shaw, reached for the handle of his revolver, and gave Shaw one more warning. "But if I find it necessary, I will put a hurt on you," said Ed. "If you cannot control yourself, I will do it for you." My brother's response to Shaw was a gentle tap upon the belligerent Shaw's head with a shooting iron. The tap on Shaw's head was designed to convince him of the vanities of this frail world. The tap on Shaw's head, however, failed to have the desired effect, and instead of dropping, as any man of finer sensibilities would have done, only burned rage through Shaw's body. He hissed at Ed like deadly poison, screeching out like volcano erupting. Fury swept off him like a ferocious wave. Shaw turned his battery upon my brother and let him have it in the right breast. The bullet from Shaw's gun struck one of Ed's ribs, passing around his chest and coming out under the right shoulder blade. The wound had the effect of paralyzing Ed's right arm, which dangled helplessly at his side. My brother quickly switched his pistol to his left hand as he fell under the impact of the heavy slug. Ed then fired two shots at Shaw. The lead from Ed's gun plugged Shaw in the left arm and left leg. Shaw then lay helpless in the sawdust of the barroom floor. During the altercation between Shaw and my brother Ed, Texas Dick was shot in the groin. Frank Buskirk, who had been attracted to the scene out of curiosity, was amply rewarded. He was shot in the left arm while looking through the entrance door of the saloon. This was Ed's first encounter with gunplay. All who witnessed the spectacle agree that my brother survived with honor. The only exception in his handling of the situation was in his hesitancy in gunning down an armed and dangerous man. When assistants arrived, they found Ed had taken authority of the situation, and he was in full control. Despite Ed's serious wound and his paralyzed right arm, he rose up to a standing position against the bar, rounded up everyone in the corner of the room except the three wounded men, two who were lying on the floor, and was holding them under his gun. My thoughts from this incident was for Ed to retire right then. He needed to preserve himself with his honorable wound and from becoming a subsequent tragedy. He just didn't have the needed killer instinct as a town-taming marshal. But everyone liked him and didn't want to offend his feelings. The city paid him the handsome sum of $23 for medical expenses and told him to return to duty when he recovered from his wound. Bob Wright told me after hearing of the Shaw incident that Ed was considered a natural gentleman, gentle and courageous, and a man of good judgment. I wasn't nearly so pleased with him. After visiting my brother in the doctor's office, recovering from his wound, I said to him, "I'll have you run out of town, Ed, unless you promise me you'll never give another gunslinger a chance like you gave Bob Shaw." "All right," said Ed, "never again." I was shrugged helplessly, unappeased by Ed's disarming smile. I knew the firmness of character that was concealed by my older brother's amiability. Ed would agree to almost anything just to save an argument, and then do things his own way. Ed returned to duty early in April of 1878, and I kept a close watch over him. But my own duties prevented me from watching him every minute of the day and night. In my own mind, I knew Ed hadn't learned his lesson. In early April is when the cattle drives began to peak. The drovers found Dodge City at the end of the trail, which represented their Valhalla, a place where they could eat and drink their fill and enjoy every vice. The cowboys had spent many long weeks sweating and freezing in the saddle. At the end of the trail, the offerings were somewhat plentiful with money in their pockets. The cowboy was easy prey for the denizens of the red light districts. He was offered every variety of liquor, games of chance, and women. One cowboy once said, "Here might be seen the frailty of women in every grade and condition, from girls in their teens launching out on a life of shame, to the adventuress who had once had youth and beauty in her favor, but was now discarded and ready for the final dose of opium and the coroner's verdict." All were there in tinsel and paint, practicing a careless exposure of their charms. It was about 10 o'clock on the night of April 9th when my brother, Ed, and Assistant Marshal Nat Haywood walked to their beat along Front Street. They heard the raucous sounds and several pistol shots. The shots were coming from below the deadline on the south side of the tracks, where anything went and was wide open. Ed and Nat Haywood hurried across the tracks to the scene of the disturbance. When they arrived at the place of the disturbance, they witnessed a half-dozen cowboys in the Lady Gay dance hall having fun and games. The cowboys, who had come in from their cow camp south of the river, cheered and showed elations over a dance hall girl. There came flashes of anger, jeers, shouting. They'd become a mob, mindless and dangerous. They had lost all self-control. Among them was the trail boss, A.M. Walker. Walker, whose father owned a fine spread of cattle in Texas, was entrusted with bringing a herd of cattle north for shipment east. One of Walker's rollicking companions was Jack Wagner. Walker had taken too much whiskey aboard, even for a thirsty cowpoke with many layers of dust to be dissolved. It was Wagner who had cut loose with the shots, and was being noisy and threatening other patrons. Ed was first to enter the Bard Dance Hall Theater. Ed witnessed that Wagner was carrying a gun. The gun was in Wagner's hand, out in the open. Ed saw that gun barrel in Walker's hand was still smoking. "You'd better check that gun with me," ordered Ed. Wagner shrugged and handed over the pistol, politely, but first. "You're smart to do as I asked," replied Ed. "I now believe the situation is under control." Ed, having retrieved Wagner's gun, strolled over to young Walker, the trail boss, and gave him Wagner's gun. "I'd suggest you leave this with the bartender until morning," ordered Ed. Walker nodded in agreement. "Yes, sir, Mr. Marshall, I'll do just that," replied Walker. Ed respectfully tipped his hat to Walker, turned, and walked out in the street. Ed must have sensed that he and Nate were being followed, for Ed turned and looked back over his shoulder, witnessing Walker and Wagner on their heels. What Ed noticed next must have surprised Wagner, who was once again in possession of a gun. "What is it you did not understand about my order?" barked Ed at Walker. "I told you not to let Wagner have his gun. Now why is Wagner carrying a gun?" Ed turned around and advanced on the pair. "I'll take that gun," he told Wagner. "You can come down to the marshal's office in the morning and collect it. That is, if you're sober enough." "Like hell I will," Wagner snarled. "You ain't got no business fooling with a man's personal shooting iron. Who the hell do you think you are?" "I'm Deputy Marshal Masterson of the Dodge City Police," Ed replied. "Now hand over that gun." Ed went for the gun Wagner was carrying and began a scuffle over possession of the revolver. The two men grunted as they took handfuls of each other's clothing and attempted to wrestle the other to the ground. By that time, four companion Texans came tumbling out of the Lady Gay. Walker and another cowboy drew their guns and covered Haywood, who had started to move to Masterson's assistance. "Keep out of this," Walker instructed Haywood. "Let him fight it out or you'll get your head blown off." Walker raised his gun so it would level at Haywood's face a few feet away. Haywood reached for his own weapon when Walker released the hammer. The hammer clicked and fell on a dud shell. The misfire of Walker's revolver screwed up Haywood's courage. Haywood became unraveled and unnerved by the click in his ear. He ran down the street for reinforcements. A few moments later, Haywood ran up to me. He stammered out the news of my brother. "Ed's in trouble, Bat," exclaimed Haywood. "He's surrounded by a mob of trigger-happy cowboys. I'm sorry, Bat, I should have stayed with him." Haywood's news of my brother being in trouble accelerated inside my head. My breaths came in gasps, and I felt like I would black out. My heart hammered inside my chest like it belonged to a rabbit running for its skin. I sprinted at full tilt towards the Lady Gay. Within a few seconds of the sight of the dance hall, I witnessed two men skirmishing outside within plain sight of my brother Ed. A shot was fired. The ground around me spun as I saw the flash of a pistol. I tried to make the scene before me slow down to something my brain and body could cope with. I felt sick. One of the men, either Wagner or Walker, had fired at Ed almost point-blank range. The flame out from the gun barrel was so close to my brother's side that it set his coat on fire. Burning and bleeding, with a bullet in the right side of Ed's abdomen, he lurched away from the scene. I was 60 feet away when the shot was fired at Ed. I saw my brother cut down without a chance to draw his own gun. A rage built up inside me like a deep water current. I did everything right. I tried to convince Ed not to take this job, and still, at this place, these boardwalks from hell took my brother with vengeance. In one blaze of a second, I fired four shots at Walker and Wagner. The two men were struggling with my brother. I gave no warning, and they had no time to know what hit them. In each of those four shots, I fired in an uncertain light, under the greatest emotional stress. Every pull of the trigger, for every blaze from my barrel, was for one purpose: to rip my two targets from existence, to silence Wagner and Walker for their crimes against my brother. Every flame from my pistol that went into the foul air of the night would be the one that laid their drunkenness to their final end. It was as if that sound became the end of a murderer, the last and brutal shout from the coldest of lungs. I then looked upon the gawking mob of sightseers in the background, who saw my vengeance play out as the lead hit one target and then the other. Jack Wagner was struck by one bullet in the left side of the abdomen. The other three slugs tattooed Walker, one hitting his lung, the other two shattering his right arm. Four of Walker's cowboy companions fled in terror, as it seemed their taste for further violence disappeared with them into the darkest shadows of the street. They were collared by other officers later that night. I holstered my revolver and watched my brother walk across the street into George Hoover's saloon. I could tell he was severely wounded. His clothes were on fire from the discharge of the pistol, which had been placed against the right side of his abdomen. By the time I reached Ed, he had collapsed on the floor of Hoover's saloon. He had a hole in his abdomen large enough for the introduction of a whole pistol. The ball passed completely through him, leaving no possible chance for life. Ed was unconscious. I picked him up off the saloon floor and had him carried to a room at Deacon Cox's establishment. I called out for someone to get a doctor. I held him until the doctor arrived. After treating my brother, the doctor said, "I'm sorry to say there's nothing more I can do." It was with those 14 words, constructed of simple letters, that cut deep into my soul. 30 minutes later, my brother Ed Masterson died in my arms. It was at this moment my eyes burned with an ache to sob. My stomach rocked back and forth on the harsh waves of fear. "Why are we taught to fear death?" I thought to myself. "Why? Whether death is an eternal abyss of darkness, a fiery pit, or a clouded castle, we all fear it, even when vexed full of courage. Whether it comes as a relief or a surprise, we fear it." I said with a whisper over Ed's cold body, "This'll just about kill our mom. She'll never forgive me for letting you get killed in this damn town." While Ed died in my arms, the fun-loving Texans who had killed my brother were suffering from my retaliation on their malicious actions. Jack Wagner stumbled into Peacock's saloon, trailing blood, and floundered towards Ham Bell. Wagner pleaded with Ham. "Catch me, I'm dying," said Wagner. Bell simply replied to Wagner's request, "I want no part of such an unpopular character as you." Bell shoved Wagner away, saying, "I can't help you now. Die for all I care." Wagner fell to the floor and lay there without medical assistance. Ham, along with several others, continued drinking at the bar as if Wagner was invisible. The drinkers at the bar continued to guzzle away until a group of silent Texans ventured into Peacock's and carried Wagner away to a rooming house. Walker, who had taken 3 bullets from my gun, was in slightly better condition than Wagner. His shirt front, covered with blood, and his almost severed right arm dangling at his side, staggered into Peacock's saloon a few moments after Wagner. Walker was also given a cold reception by Ham Bell. "I'd like to surrender my gun to you, sir," Walker announced. "Throw it on the floor if you don't want it," he said. Walker dropped the gun, noted the hostile stares of Bell and the others at the bar, and made his way out the back door of the saloon where he collapsed. Walker's friends found him later and hauled him into a room over Bob Wright's mercantile house. His wealthy father came up from Texas a few weeks later and took Walker home, assured by the physicians that he had a good chance of recovery. But young Walker died of his lung wound about a month after the shooting, the third man to die under my gun. Wagner confessed to the killing of Ed Masterson before he died the next day and was buried on Boot Hill. Little sympathy was expended on the dead and dying Texans, but the town of Dodge City truly mourned for Ed Masterson. The Ford County Globe reported in my brother's eulogy, "Everyone in the city knew Ed Masterson and liked him. They liked him as a boy, they liked him as a man, and they liked him as their marshal. The marshal died nobly in the discharge of duty. We drop a tear upon his grave and remember. Whether on the scaffold high or in the battle's van, the fittest place for man to die is when he dies for man." Dodge City gave my brother Ed its first public funeral, and probably its most sincerely regretful one. All the stores and even the saloons closed the day his body was carried to the cemetery. The funeral procession was headed by the city council and included the volunteer fire company, of which Ed had been a prominent member. All 60 of Ed's firefighting comrades attended, wearing their uniform and mourning bands. I was the only relative present. I followed the hearse alone on foot. My eyes were entirely fixed on the glass-sided wagon, which buried my brother's body until we reached Fort Dodge. The public outpouring of sympathy was of much consolation as I watched the Reverend Ormond Wright sprinkle dirt over my brother's coffin as it was lowered into the grave. As the Reverend Wright began his oration over the grave, I only heard, "Dust to dust, ashes to ashes." I could only think then to my mother's religious teachings and how these teachings of Christian way of life made a far deeper impression on Ed than on me. If Ed had been a little less Christian and shot those two Texans before they could grapple with him, he wouldn't be lying in that coffin. This was no country in which to love thy neighbor. It wasn't safe to follow the golden rule west of Kansas City on the boardwalks from hell.